91. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. In spite of his fears and forebodings, Monday was going well. Innocenti felt some lingering anxiety, but by early afternoon he had regained his equilibrium, and he did not lose it again. It was imperative now to take refuge in a theatre for the evening, so that he could stop fearing every ring at the door. But the phone rang. It was almost theatre time, and Dottie was just emerging from the bathroom. Innocenti stood staring at the telephone, like a dog at a hedgehog. "Dottie, answer the phone. I'm not in, and you don't know when I'll be back. They'll ruin our evening, damn them." Dottie had become even prettier since yesterday. She always became prettier when she was admired, and then she was admired even more and became prettier still. Holding the skirts of her dressing gown together with one hand, she padded over to the telephone and gently but firmly picked up the receiver.
"Yes? He's not at home."
"Who?
Who?"
Suddenly she was all affability. That little lift of the shoulders was always a sign of eagerness to please.
"Good evening, Comrade General. Yes, I'll find out right away."
She quickly covered the phone with her hand and whispered,
"The boss. Sounds very friendly."
Innocenti wavered. The boss sounding friendly, calling in person in the evening. His wife noticed his indecision.
"Just a minute. I can hear the door opening. It could be him." "Yes, it is. Inny, don't stop to take your coat off. Come quickly. The general's on the phone."
However incorrigibly suspicious-minded the person at the other end of the telephone might be, from the tone of Dottie's voice he could almost see Innocenti hurriedly wiping his feet at the door, crossing the carpeted floor, and taking the receiver. The boss was in a good mood. His message was that Innocenti's posting had just been finally confirmed. He would fly out on Wednesday, changing planes in Paris. He was to hand over the last of his current work tomorrow, and come along for half an hour right now to clear up one or two details. A car had already been sent for him. Innocenti straightened up from the telephone a different man. He took such a deep breath in his happiness that the air seemed to have time to permeate his whole body. He breathed out slowly, and, with the air, expelled his doubts and fears. Incredible! He had walked the tightrope in a crosswind without falling. Just imagine, Dottie. I'm flying on Wednesday. And right now... Dottie, with one ear to the receiver, had heard it all for herself. But as she straightened up, she was obviously far from happy. Innocenti's departure alone, explicable and acceptable the day before yesterday, was hurtful and humiliating today.
"Do you think," she said, looking sulky, "the one or two details might possibly include me?"
"Yes, well, maybe.
"What did you tell them about me, anyway?"
"Well, he had said something. Said something he couldn't now repeat to her, and it was too late now to play it differently." But with the confidence she had gained yesterday, Dottie was able to speak freely.
"Inny, we've always made our discoveries together. We've always shared new experiences. You wouldn't go to see the Yellow Devil without me, would you? No, I simply can't accept it. You've got to think about the two of us."
This was nothing compared to what she would come out with later. In the presence of foreigners, she would be repeating the most stupidly orthodox banalities, which would make Innocenti's ears burn. She would be vilifying America and buying everything she could lay her hands on there. But he was forgetting. It wouldn't be like that. He would come clean once he got there, and how much of it would she be capable of understanding? "It will all work out, Dottie, but it takes time. Right now I have to go and present myself, complete the formalities, get to know people,
but I want to go right away. Right now is when I want to go. I can't be left behind."
She did not know what she would be letting herself in for. She did not know what it was like having a twisted, round rope under slippery soles. And now he would have to spring from his perch and fly through the air, perhaps without a safety net. A second body, plump and soft and unused to hardship, could not fly beside him. Innocenti smiled nicely and shook his wife gently by her shoulders.
"Well, I'll try. It isn't what was agreed before, but let's see how it goes now. In any case, you needn't worry. I will send for you very soon."
He kissed an unresponsive cheek. Dotty was not at all convinced. The harmony established yesterday was forgotten.
"Anyway, get dressed now. No need to hurry. We will miss the first act, but that won't spoil the whole thing. We'll get there for Act Two. Anyway, I'll give you a tinkle from the ministry."
He scarcely had time to don his uniform before the driver rang the doorbell. It was neither Victor, who usually drove him, nor Kostya. This driver was a lean, lively fellow with a pleasant, intelligent face. He went down the stairs jauntily, almost side by side with Innocenti, twirling the ignition key on its cord.
"I don't remember seeing you before,"
Innocenti said, buttoning his overcoat as he went.
"I even remember your stairway. I've picked you up twice before."
The driver's smile was genuine, but vaguely mischievous. It would be good to have a bright fellow like this driving your own car. They drove off. Innocenti had taken the rear seat. The driver twice tried to make a joke over his shoulder, but Innocenti wasn't listening. Suddenly the car swerved sharply and pulled up flush with the pavement. A young man wearing a soft hat and an overcoat pinched in at the waist was standing at the curb with his finger raised.
"A mechanic from our garage,"
the amiable driver explained, and made as if to open the right-hand front door. But the door simply refused to open. The lock was jammed. The driver swore without exceeding the limits of urban decency and said,
"Comrade councillor, could he possibly sit next to you? It's a bit awkward because he's my boss."
"Yes, of course," Innocenti readily agreed, making room for him. He was intoxicated, overexcited, mentally holding out his hand for his letter of appointment and visa, imagining himself boarding the morning plane at Vnukovo the day after tomorrow. But he would not begin to relax before he got to Warsaw, and even there a telegram might arrive to stop his journey. The mechanic, gripping a long, lighted cigarette with the corner of his mouth, got into the car with an offhand,
"All right by you,"
and plopped down beside Innocenti. The car jerked forward. Innocenti scowled at him in disgust. What a bore. But was soon absorbed in his thoughts again, ignoring the route. Puffing at his cigarette, the mechanic had already half-filled the car with smoke. Time to put him in his place.
"Could you perhaps open the window?" Innocenti said, raising just his right eyebrow.
Irony was lost on the mechanic. Instead of opening the window, he lay back in his seat, took a piece of paper from his inside pocket, unfolded it, and held it out to Innocenti.
"Comrade Chief, could you kindly read this for me? I'll shine a light."
The car turned sharply into a steep, ill-lit street, possibly Pushechnaya. The mechanic shone a pocket flashlight on a scrap of pinkish paper. Shrugging his shoulders, Innocenti grudgingly accepted the sheet of paper and began reading casually, as if to himself. "Authorized, Deputy Prosecutor General, USSR." He was still too engrossed in his own thoughts to wonder whether the mechanic was illiterate, simply incapable of understanding the document, or perhaps drunk and anxious to confide in somebody. "Warrant for the arrest," he read, still not taking in what he was reading. "Of Volodin Innocenti Artemievich, born 1919. And only then did a single great needle pierce his body from top to bottom and scalding heat envelop it. Innocenti opened his mouth, but before he could utter a sound, before the hand holding the pink page fell on his knees, the mechanic had gripped his shoulder in a painful hold and growled menacingly, "Easy now, take it easy. Don't move or I'll strangle you here." He blinded Volodin with the flashlight, blew cigarette smoke into his face, and retrieved the document. Innocenti had read that he was arrested, which spelled disaster and the end of his life. But for one brief moment what he could not bear was the man's insolence, his vice-like grip, the cigarette smoke, and the light shining in his face.
"Let go!"
he cried, trying to free himself with his own weak fingers. It had finally sunk in that this really was a warrant for his arrest, but it might, he thought, be merely an unfortunate coincidence that he had landed in this car and given the mechanic a lift? He imagined that if only he could shake them off and get to his boss in the ministry, the warrant would be cancelled. He tugged convulsively at the handle of the left side door, but it would not give. It, too, was jammed.
"Driver, you'll answer for this. What is the meaning of this provocation?"
Innocenti cried angrily.
"I serve the Soviet Union, Councillor,"
the driver rapped out, with an insolent glance over his shoulder. Obeying the traffic regulations, the car circled the whole brightly lit expanse of Lubyanka Square, as though it were making a valedictory round, giving Innocenti one last look at this world, and the five-story bulk of the amalgamated old and new Lubyankas, where he was to end his life. Cars clustered at the traffic lights and then broke free. Trolleys swished past, buses honked. People walked by in dense crowds, and no one knew or saw the victim being dragged to execution before their very eyes. A little red flag, lit up by a searchlight from a recess in the roof, flapped in a gap between the columns of the tower above the old great Lubyanka. It was like Garshin's little red flower which had absorbed all the world's evil. Two insensate stone naiads, semi-recumbent, gazed down scornfully at the miniature citizens pottering about below. The car drove past the facade of the world-famous building, which levied tribute in human lives from all continents, and turned into Great Lubyanka Street.
"Let go, I tell you!"
Innocenti was still struggling to shake free of the mechanic's fingers, which were digging into his shoulder near the neck. The black iron gate opened as soon as the car pointed its radiator at them, and closed again as soon as it had passed through. The car coasted through the dark gateway into the yard. The mechanic had relaxed his hold in the gateway. Once in the yard, he removed his hand from Innocenti's neck.
"Out we get,"
he said peremptorily, as he scrambled from the car. By now it was obvious that he was perfectly sober. The driver also got out.
"Out with you. Hands behind your back," he ordered. Could this icy voice of command really belong to the jester of a little while back?
Innocenti climbed out of the man-trap on wheels, straightened up, and, although there was no obvious reason for him to do so, obediently put his hands behind his back. The arrest had been rough, but not so terrifying as might be expected. He even felt a certain relief. No more need to fear, no need to struggle, no need to plot and plan. He felt the pleasurable, numb relaxation that sometimes pervades the body of a wounded man. Innocenti surveyed the small yard, which was patchily lit by two or three lights and lamps here and there in upper windows. Walled in by towering buildings, the yard was like the bottom of a well.
"No looking around," the driver barked. "Move!"
With Innocenti in the middle, the three of them filed past uninterested MGB personnel, under a low arch, down steps into another little yard, dark under a low roof, turned left, and discovered a neat front door, like the entrance to an eminent physician's office. The door opened onto a short, very tidy corridor, flooded with electric light. Its freshly painted floor seemed to have been washed very recently, and a strip of carpet ran down the middle. The driver made a strange clicking noise with his tongue, as if he were calling a dog. But there was no dog. The corridor ended at a glass door with faded curtains on the other side. The door was reinforced by a steel grille of the sort used to fence flower beds at railway stations. On the door, instead of a doctor's nameplate, there was a sign saying, "Reception of prisoners." There was no line. They rang. The bell was an antique with a handle to turn. After a while, someone peeked around the curtain, then opened the door. A guard, with a long, blank face, wearing sky-blue epaulets with the sergeant's white stripes across them. The driver took the pink form from the mechanic and showed it to the guard. He scanned it indifferently, as a drowsy pharmacist disturbed in the night might read a prescription, and the two of them went inside. Innocenti and the mechanic stood in profound silence outside the firmly closed door. Reception of prisoners made him think of another sign meaning much the same. Mortuary. Innocenti couldn't even be bothered to take a good look at the smart aleck in the sharp overcoat, who was playing this silly game with him. He should perhaps have been protesting, shouting, demanding justice. But he had even forgotten that he was clasping his hands behind his back, and continued to hold them there. Thinking had come to a dead stop. He stared like a man under hypnosis at the words, "Reception of prisoners." There was the sound of a key turning smoothly in an English lock. The long-faced guard nodded them in and went ahead, making those dog-calling clicks with his tongue. Still no dog. This corridor was just as brightly lit and just as clinically clean. There were two doors in the wall, both painted olive green. The sergeant flung one of them open and said, "Inside." Innocenti went in. He had scarcely had time to look around and see that the room was empty, except for a large, rough table and a pair of stools, and that it was windowless, when two of them jumped on him, the driver from the one side, the mechanic from behind, held him with all four arms, and adroitly searched his pockets. "What's the meaning of this thuggery?" Innocenti cried feebly. "What right do you have?" He resisted briefly, but the realization that this was not a mugging, but men carrying out a routine duty, robbed his resistance of force and his voice of conviction. They removed his wristwatch and fished out two notebooks, a fountain pen, and a handkerchief. He caught sight also of the narrow silver epaulets in their hands, and was struck by the coincidence that they, too, belonged to the diplomatic service and had the same number of stars as he did. They relaxed their rough embrace, and the mechanic held out the handkerchief. "Take it." Innocenti shuddered. "After it's been in your dirty hands," he said shrilly. The handkerchief fell to the floor. "You'll get a receipt for your valuables," the driver said, and they both hurried out. The long-faced sergeant, however, was in no hurry. Glancing at the floor, he advised Innocenti to pick up the handkerchief. Innocenti did not bend down. "What have they done? Have they ripped my epaulets off?" He had only now realized, feeling under his overcoat, that they were no longer on the shoulders of his uniform. He was furious.
"Hands behind your back," the sergeant said tonelessly. "March."
He clicked his tongue. Still no dog. Rounding a sharp bend, they found themselves in another corridor, with facing rows of small olive-green doors in close succession, each with a shiny oval number plate. A careworn middle-aged woman in army regulation skirt and tunic, and the same light blue epaulettes with sergeant's white stripes, was walking between the rows of doors. As Innocenti and the guard appeared from around the bend, she took a quick look through the peephole in one of the doors. When they drew level, she let the flap fall back over the peephole and looked at Innocenti, as though he had walked that way hundreds of times before, and she was not a bit surprised to see him walking there yet again. Her face was somber. She inserted a long key into the steel casing of the lock on a door numbered 8, unlocked it noisily, and nodded to him. "Inside." Innocenti crossed the threshold, and before he could turn around and ask for an explanation, the door was shut behind him and the key grated the lock. So this was now to be his home. For a day? For months? For years and years? His quarters could not be called a room or even a cell, because, as we know from literature, a cell must have a window, if only a little one, and room to pace the floor. Here, not only pacing the floor, not only lying down, but even sitting comfortably was impossible. A small table and stool occupied almost all the floor space. If you sat on the stool, you could not stretch your legs out freely. There was nothing else in the cell. To chest height, the walls were panelled and painted dark green. The upper part of the walls and the ceiling were whitewashed and glaringly illuminated by a big 200-watt electric bulb enclosed in a wire basket. Innocenti sat down. 20 minutes ago, he had still been imagining himself arriving in America and, of course, reminding them of his telephone call to the embassy. 20 minutes ago, his past life had seemed to him a harmonious whole. Every event lit by the steady light of premeditation and welded to other events by white flashes of good fortune. But after the last 20 minutes, his whole past life seemed to him just as certainly an agglomeration of errors, a heap of meaningless fragments. Sounds from the corridor reached him only twice, when a nearby door was opened and closed. Every minute the little disc over the glazed peephole was disturbed, and a single inquisitorial eye observed Innocenti. The door was 4 fingers thick, and the spy-hole ran right through it, a cone of which the optic was the apex. Innocenti surmised that it was made this way so that there was nowhere in this torture chamber for the prisoner to escape the guard's gaze. It was hot and stuffy. He took off his warm winter overcoat and squinted miserably at the ragged holes where his epaulets had been torn from his uniform. Finding neither a nail nor any sort of protuberance on the walls, he laid his overcoat and hat on the little table. Strangely, now that lightning had struck and he has been arrested, Innocenti felt no fear. On the contrary, his mind was released from its temporary paralysis, and he began going over the blunders he had made. Why had he not read the warrant in full? Was it drawn up correctly? Did it have the official stamp? The public prosecutor's authorization? Ah, yes, of course. It invoked the public prosecutor's authority right at the beginning. On what date was the warrant signed? What was he charged with? Did the boss know about it when he sent for me? He must have known. So his summons was a trick. But why this bizarre procedure? Why this farce with the driver and the mechanic? In one of his pockets his hand felt something small and hard. He took it out. An elegant miniature pencil. It had detached itself from a notebook. Innocenti was greatly cheered by this little pencil. It could prove to be very useful. Rank amateurs. Even here in the Lyubyanka, they were rank amateurs, didn't even know how to search a prisoner. Trying to think of the best place to hide the pencil, Innocenti broke it in two and eased one half under the sole of each of his shoes. Heavens, how careless! He hadn't noticed what he was accused of. Perhaps his arrest had nothing at all to do with that telephone call. Perhaps it was a mistake, a coincidence. What was the correct way to behave now? Maybe there was nothing they could accuse him of. Probably not. Let's just arrest him. He had not been there very long, but several times already he had heard the steady hum of some sort of machine beyond the wall farthest from the corridor. A disturbing thought suddenly occurred to Innocenti. What sort of machine would you expect to find in a place like this? This was a prison, not a factory. Why the machinery? Any man of the 40s had heard so much about mechanical means of destroying people that something sinister immediately came to mind. A thought, at once bizarre and yet highly probable, flashed through Innocenti's mind. That this was a machine for grinding the bones of murdered prisoners. He felt frightened. Yes, by now the thought stung worse than ever. What a mistake not even to read the warrant through, not to begin protesting his innocence then and there. He had submitted to arrest so meekly that they must be convinced of his guilt. How could he have failed to protest? Why, oh why, had he not protested? It must look for all the world as if he had been expecting arrest, that he was resigned to it. He was cut to the quick by this fatal mistake. His first thought was to jump up, thump and kick, yell at the top of his voice that he was innocent, but second and wiser thoughts prevailed. None of that would come as a surprise to them. No doubt people were always banging and shouting here, and his silence in the first few minutes had complicated things anyway. To think that he had let himself be taken so easily. A high-ranking diplomat allowing himself to be plucked from his apartment, from the streets of Moscow, carried off and locked up in this torture chamber with no attempt to resist, without a sound. There could be no escape from here. No escape from here. Unless, perhaps, the chief was still expecting him. Was there any way to get through to the chief, if only under escort? How to find out? No. His thoughts were becoming no clearer, only more confused and complicated. The machine beyond the wall hummed and was silent by turns. Innocenti's eyes, blinded by the artificial light that was too bright for this high but narrow 3 cubic meters of space, had for some time sought relief by resting on the single black square that broke the monotony of the ceiling. This square of wire mesh was, to all appearances, an air vent, though it was uncertain what it led to or away from. Then, suddenly, it was starkly obvious that this vent was not a vent at all, but poisonous gas was gradually released through it, perhaps produced by that very same humming machine that they had been pumping gas in from the very first minute he had been shut in there, and that such a hermetically sealed cell, with not even the narrowest of cracks between door and floor, could have no other purpose. That was why they kept spying on him through the peephole, to see whether he was still conscious or already gassed. And that was why his thoughts were so confused. He was losing consciousness. That was why for some time now he had been short of breath. That was why there was such a pounding in his head. Gas was seeping in, colourless, odourless. Terror. The primitive animal terror that unites predators and their prey in a single stampeding herd fleeing from a forest fire gripped Innocenti, and incapable by now of any other thought, he began hammering on the door with fists and feet, calling upon any living being.
Open up! Open up! I'm suffocating! Give me air!
That was another reason why the spy hole was conical. No fist could reach the glass to break it. An unblinking eye pressed against the glass on the other side and gloated over the wreckage of Innocenti. What a spectacle! The detached eye, the eye without a face, the eye that has concentrated all expression in itself, now watching you die. There was no way out. Innocenti collapsed onto the stool. The gas was suffocating him.